I'll open my grapevine and see that, read about Reconciliation Week and be reminded of just how bad we often are at reconciling and living together as humans on this planet. As much as we like people and like to spend time with each other, inevitably we have struggles. It's very easy to see in my children, usually because their version of conflict is rather concentrated and an uncomplicated version of my own. When one of them's upset, it's very easy to see they're upset because they yell or hit or do whatever that they do when a sibling annoys them. If a grown-up annoys me, I usually use sneakily, socially acceptable ways of punching them, which is more like being passive-aggressive or annoying them in other ways or just avoiding them. Conflict is inevitable in this world, and often it can end in broken relationships which hurt and are terrible. Today, we're going to get a little glimmer of hope in a world of conflict. We see something of the power of God to reconcile people. We're in the late stages of the book of Genesis, and throughout the book there has been this common theme of conflict and tension and broken relationships. We started with God creating a perfect and ordered world for us to live in and have relationship with him and with each other. This did not last long as the humans wanted to decide good and evil for themselves apart from God, and they brought chaos into the world. Along with this, broken relationships followed. They could no longer live in the garden, otherwise they might live forever and inflict pain and suffering on each other indefinitely. They could no longer spend time in God's presence. And now there was going to be tension between the relationships between husbands and wife. Her desire would be for her husband, and he would rule over her. We saw tension and competition between people appear early on as, in a jealous rage, one of Adam and Eve's sons killed his brother. From there, humanity continued to live in a cycle of fear and violence and broken relationships. The violence between people is what caused God to send the flood to wipe out most of the world. After the flood, people showed that when they worked together in harmony at the Tower of Babel, they worked to control and manipulate God and mess with that relationship. So he scattered them. But through it all, God has promised to fix what was broken. He chose a man to be a father of a new humanity who would live in relationship with him. He chose a man named Abraham who left his land, his gods, his people, and his family to start fresh. And the results were mixed. Abraham was still often gripped with fear and distrust and often made many mistakes. But God showed him constantly that he was faithful and kind, and he loved him every step of the way. When Abraham had two sons, tension and broken relationships rocked their house as there was jealousy between their mothers, and then tension between the brothers Isaac and Ishmael. As one was chosen to carry the blessing, and there was always conflict between them. Abraham's son Isaac then had twins of his own, and there was tension and quarrelling over birthrights and blessings from their father. This led to one of them running and hiding in fear. Eventually, they patched things up, but it was not super convincing. Now we're looking at the sons of Jacob. He had 12 sons to 4 women and was not shy about choosing favourites. I put them on the front of the grapevine today so to jog everyone's memory of how the family's put together, because it's weird and messy. Jacob's favourite sons were from his favourite wife, Rachel. They were also the youngest. And after Benjamin was born, Rachel passed away. We then saw that the favoritism towards Joseph caused tension, and In this, his 10 older brothers tried to kill him. Reuben, the firstborn who should be the hero, failed to save him and restore him to his father. But his brother Judah inadvertently saved his life when he convinced the brothers that it would be more profitable to sell him into slavery instead of killing him. We saw Joseph sold to slavery in Egypt and then falsely accused of a crime and go to prison. But through it all, he trusted God and God was faithful to him. After 13 years in captivity, he's brought into Pharaoh's presence to interpret dreams, and God reveals the dreams to him, saying, there will be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine, and Pharaoh puts him in charge of all of Egypt to manage them through the plenty so they can survive the famine. Through Joseph's wise managing, they save enough grain to save the people when the famine comes. Today we'll see what happens when Joseph finally comes face to face with the brothers who betrayed him. Now the famine affects everyone, and even Jacob and his family in Canaan are running out of food. Now this part of the story is very detailed and we're going to fly through it today, but I recommend that you read it slowly when you go home if you haven't read it recently, just to experience the story. Now, I only had Melinda read one chapter, but she did such a good job, I would have liked her to continue, actually. And then I wouldn't need to do this. But you can see from the way that she read it that it's just a rich, vibrant story to experience. And often we look at it with Sunday school glasses on and forget the vibrant truth that is in it. And that it's full of emotion and clever character details that really show them as real people. Well, it starts with Jacob. He turns to his sons and he says, why are you just sitting around looking at each other? I heard there's grain in Egypt. Why don't you go down there and buy some so that we don't starve? He sounds like a father to me. So the 10 oldest brothers go to Egypt. They leave Benjamin, Jacob's favourite, and the last thing remaining of his wife Rachel safely at home. Joseph has left his time in his father's house behind him. His life is good now. He is being used by God to save all of the area and the surrounds from starving to death. He named one of his children Forget because God caused him to forget the suffering of his father's house. So it seems reasonable that Joseph thought that he would probably never see his brothers again, and he was probably pretty content with that. And then Joseph's 10 brothers come. They come before him to buy grain, just as many people in the surrounding areas were doing. They came in and bowed before him, just as anyone else would have done because of his high position. Joseph, though, recognized them instantly, and he also remembered the dreams about them bowing before him. And now the situation that follows is a little difficult to interpret. Joseph's motives are never discussed in the story. Now, some people want to interpret Joseph as infallible, like everything he does is perfect, and they would make his action seem like deliberate and calculated tests. But when I read the story, it's very clearly filled with emotion from all of the brothers. I think Joseph's actions are a mixture of him trying to find out what is going on with this group who hurt him so badly so long ago. I think some of it is vindictive, and some of it is him trying to work out if they have changed. And yet there's also this other side of him where he seems to want to lavish his brothers with success and raise up his whole family in their situation. And then on top of it all, he's also trying to follow God faithfully in it. Like all the stories in Genesis, the people in them are so very human in the way that they act. It is realistically messy. So the brothers come and bow before him, and the tables have turned since their last meeting. So Joseph accuses them of being spies, and he interrogates them about their family. They don't recognize him as, well, they assume that he's dead, and he's dressed as an Egyptian, speaking Egyptian, and having a servant interpret for him. Joseph says that he needs to test their story by sending one brother home and bringing back their youngest brother, and Joseph's only full brother, Benjamin, whom he loves. So Joseph puts the brothers in prison for 3 days. Joseph then, saying that it's because he fears God, he will let them go, take back grain so that their family won't starve, but he will leave one brother imprisoned until they can bring back Benjamin and prove that they are honest. The brothers then start blaming each other for the situation, saying that this is the judgment of God because of what they did to Joseph. And Reuben tries to tell them, "I told you so," but nobody listens to Reuben. Joseph understands them, unbeknownst to them, and he turns away from them and he weeps. He comes back and he takes Simeon away to put him in prison until they bring back Benjamin. He loads up their donkeys and he gives them all of their silver back. He puts it in the mouth of their sacks. Now, whether this was a sign of generosity to his brothers or a test to see their honesty, we don't know. But when the brothers discover it, they are terrified. The governor who spoke harshly to them, accused them of being spies, would now have evidence of them stealing from him. And then they say, "What has God done to us?" Which is a really interesting statement, as they're saying it as a negative, and yet we know what God has done is incredibly positive. It's one of those little nuanced moments in the story where we can see that God's hand is bigger than the human comprehension at the time. They get back home and they tell Jacob what has happened. And he acts like a sad, obstinate old man. He complains about the loss of Joseph and now the loss of Simeon. And now they want to take Benjamin away from him. And he says, "Everything is against me." Reuben tries to be the hero again and promises that if he can't return Benjamin, then Jacob can kill Reuben's 2 sons. And as usual, nobody listens to Reuben. Jacob refuses and continues to sulk. After a while, their food runs out, so Jacob sends them back to Egypt to get more. But Judah speaks to him this time, and after quite a bit of convincing, Jacob agrees to send Benjamin, as well as send a bunch of gifts to butter up the governor and to prove that they aren't thieves or spies. So they put the money that they should have paid last time in the sack, as well as new money for the new supplies. When they return to Joseph, he brings them all back to his house, and then he lavishes them with good food and a delicious lunch. They confess to Joseph's steward that they found the money returned in their sacks, and the steward says he had received their money. God must have given them the money that was in their sacks. At lunch, Joseph is so happy to see Benjamin that he hides himself to cry, and he gives Benjamin 5 times the amount of food of anyone else. Joseph then fills their sacks as much as possible and puts all of their money back in the sacks again. He also plants his silver cup in Benjamin's bag and he lets them go and then quickly sends the steward out after them to catch them and accuse them of stealing. They attest to their innocence and say that if someone is found to have stolen the cup, then that brother will die and the rest can come and be Joseph's slaves. The steward, however, says, "Whoever has the cup will become Joseph's slaves and then the rest can go free." He finds the cup in Benjamin's sack. They all head back to the city and are before Joseph. Now, this is the same situation that the brothers found themselves in over 20 years beforehand, when they had the opportunity to get rid of the favourite son for their own advantage. And Judah had convinced them all to sell Joseph into slavery so he could get the money. Now they can leave Benjamin here and head off home with the grain and the money and get his inheritance. Jacob kind of said, "Well, whatever happens, happens. We need to get this food." So he might be all right with it. We don't know. But this is the ultimate test to see whether or not the brothers have changed. Will they do the same thing to Benjamin that they did to Joseph? And for Joseph, if they do leave Benjamin with him, at least he has his brother with him now. However, Judah gets up and he makes an impassioned plea on behalf of his father, who will not take the news well. He says that Benjamin is his responsibility and he offers to take his place as Joseph's servant. Now, this is a far cry from the Judah that we know so far, the one who sold Joseph into slavery and shirked his responsibilities when it came to Tamar. It seems that they have changed. They have grown as people. Judah says, "Now then, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, don't let me see the misery that would come on my father." At this point, Joseph can't control himself any longer. He sends all of the Egyptian attendants out of the room so that he's alone with his brothers, and he weeps loudly, so loudly that the Egyptians outside hear what is going on anyway. Joseph says to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" The brothers are shocked and scared. They can't speak. The last they saw Joseph was when they were getting ready to kill him, but then sold him into slavery instead. And now he is the Egyptian governor who they have just been caught stealing from, and he has treated them harshly. And it turns out that he is Joseph, the one that they betrayed. He calls his brothers in close, and he tells them not to be afraid. Do not be angry with themselves because of what they did, because God was actually putting him ahead of them into Egypt so that he could save many lives during the famine. He tells them that they can all come and live in Egypt, and he will provide for them during the famine. He hugs his full brother Benjamin and weeps, and then he kisses all his brothers and they spend time talking together. Pharaoh hears from the servants about what's going on, and he's actually delighted. He lavishes all the brothers with gifts. And this time, instead of Joseph's clothes changing to signal a change in status, Pharaoh gives all of the brothers new clothes. And Joseph sends them back home to bring their father back with them. And as they're leaving, he says to them, "Don't quarrel on the way, just as a snarky brother would do." So they go, they tell Jacob everything, and he believes them. He's overjoyed, and they all pack up their families and move to Egypt. Before they leave, Jacob has a dream from God where God tells him that he will be with him in Egypt, and he will bring him back to this land again. And that is where we leave the story today. There's much more detail in the Bible that I haven't got through. So read it when you get home and try to forget the ending so that you have an opportunity to feel the intense drama of it all. Now, this story makes for a good Sunday school story. It has everything. The Joseph deception makes for a tense drama. There's plenty of visual things that you can make a craft out of. But at the heart of the story, there is a family that reconciles and forgives each other. Now, for the most part of the book of Genesis, relationships break and they don't often mend. Even the ones that look like they mend, it's usually more like a band-aid on the top of a much worse wound. But this is the first time that we've seen an indication of the broken relationships that we see happen over and over again actually get fixed. It also gives us hope that the brothers have seemed to grow and change from their selfish, deceptive, and conniving ways. Throughout the whole book of Genesis, we have been plotting humanity's descent as they get worse and worse. We have seen God choose a family through whom he will enact his rescue plan, and they have not seemed much better than the rest of the world. But in this moment, we have God redeeming this broken family and reconciling them. The broken relationship is fixed. Now, we know that there will be much more about this in other parts of the Bible, but the book of Genesis has mostly given us reason to be pessimistic about humanity. And here, as we reach the end, there is this glimmer of hope that broken relationships can be fixed. Despite the constant failure of humans, God can restore relationships. Now, Joseph starts the story today content with forgetting his family and moving on. And then when he sees them, there's this mix of emotions and difficult actions where he doesn't seem to know exactly whether to kill them on the spot or torture them or to lavish them with love and expensive gifts. Ultimately, we see Joseph find out that in God's grace, his brothers have changed and he forgives them based on his faith in what God is doing. There is hope in broken relationships. Now, lucky for us, we are a little further on in God's salvation plan. The broken relationships that we usually experience are a reflection of the first broken relationship, the one between humanity and God. Once the humans chose their pride over their relationship with God, we have constantly made the same mistake with each other. Being a person with other people around can be wonderful, but it can also be hard. And at the worst of it, relationships are destroyed and break down. When we follow our own way in spite of everyone else, inevitably where there will be times when we can no longer stand each other. We know that this is bad for us, and yet we often can't break through the pain that someone else has caused us. We can't see past our own pride sometimes. And in that, I imagine how God feels. He has created us all and he loves us so deeply that he keeps account of all the hairs that are on our head. He lovingly knit us together in our mother's wombs, and yet we often spend our lives in opposition to him and the things that he wants for us. Also, the people that we hurt with our actions and our pride, he deeply loves them as well and doesn't want to see them hurt. We know that further along the salvation story, God sent his son Jesus to come and live a perfect life, one that was in harmony with him. When Jesus went around, the signs of brokenness in this world were fixed. When the people whom God loved and was trying to save, they then took Jesus because he threatened their power and their pride, and they put him to death. Now, normally this sort of act should inspire revenge, and yet in this act, Jesus took on the guilt and the shame of all of humanity's selfish and destructive actions, and he paid the price so that we can be reconciled and forgiven. We can have our relationship with God restored. As people who follow God, we also follow God's example, and now we are no longer people who dwell in our hatred and resentment, but we have the power to forgive others and reconcile with them, just as God did with us. Now it's very easy to talk about forgiveness and restoring relationships as a goal without really getting into the nitty-gritty of our hurts and our emotions. It is one thing to bring us stories of great forgiveness and know that it's the right thing to do, but it's another thing to experience it. To see a person who has hurt you for whatever reason and to decide that you're no longer going to hold it against that person. I find that I am very good at making a decision to forgive an action until that person does a similar action against me, and then that just adds to the pile of things that I thought I had forgiven but really didn't. Unfortunately, it is something that I'm very good at deceiving myself about. And yet in this story, we have hope. Hope that there will be forgiveness and reconciliation. We have the promise from God that he can grow selfish, murderous brothers into self-sacrificing, loving brothers. He can take a broken family and fix it. So wherever you are in your journey with God, and whatever hurts you are experiencing and feel like you need to forgive, this story shows us that there is hope with God. We stick with him, we trust him, we need to be able to trust him with our hurts. Now, it won't happen easily often. It is a journey, and that's why we trust and we hope. But God is the God of reconciliation, and we know that with him we can live in harmony, even if we can't see it yet. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, Thank you for your love and your care for us. Thank you when we were terrible at relationships, you are someone who wants good for us. As we go throughout our weeks, each of us deals with different hurts and different problems every day, and I pray, Lord, that we can look to you in them. We can trust in you, trust you with our hurts, and trust you with our hopes. I pray, Lord, that you will help us to forgive when we need to, even if that takes time. I pray that we can trust your Son and the forgiveness that you've given us through that. And as we go throughout our week, Lord, I pray we can show others the hope that is in you as well. I pray all these things in Jesus' name, for your glory. Amen.